The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Tax bill passes in the wee hours of the morning. Market rallies throughout the week in anticipation of it. And political tensions are rising. Our guest today, Frank Curzio from Curzio Research. All this and much more on episode number 537 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hi, and how are you? This is Andrew Horowitz, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for being here today. And thanks for being there always, telling your friends, family, coworkers, and everybody on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram about the show. I really appreciate it. If you haven't done so already, I do ask you to send out a little message to some people that you know to listen in on this so they can get their dose of financial, well, news, wisdom, insight, education each and every week here as we talk about all sorts of different topics. Now I'm going to get right to our guest today because I think we're going to spend some time with him talking about a full range of information, ideas, some stocks to take a look at, as well as the tax bill. I got so many things to talk about, so let's get right to it. And our guest today is Frank Curzio from Curzio Research. You know him, but I thought what we would do is, it's kind of getting towards the end of the year. You know, we got those holiday spirits out there. We're all stuffed from Thanksgiving. It's beyond that. We have a few weeks left to this incredible year in the markets. I thought we would do some recap, a look at what's going on in economics, a whole bunch of things and cover it. And who best to do it with, and who better to do it with than Frank Curzio. Frank, what's going on?
How's it going, man? How's everything going? It's been a little while, right? I mean, since I've been on your podcast, a couple months.
Yeah, a few months, and we can't go much longer because I start getting jittery.
No, me too. That's why I love having you on my podcast too, buddy.
So what's going on? I mean, listen, there's a lot happening. We know that in the markets, and we know that, first of all, how's your Thanksgiving?
Oh, it was great. The holiday was great. Spent time with the family. I actually spent it in Jamaica with a couple of close friends, and but it was good. It was relaxful because it's been really busy with Curzio Research. What about you? How was the holiday?
Jamaica, Queens, or Jamaica, the islands?
Jamaica, the islands.
The islands, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I went to some family, you know, the usual family hoo-ha. There was like 25 of us. We had turducken that the guy made. We had all these foods and all that. We, four of us, drank two bottles of scotch. That's my kind of Thanksgiving.
That's the way it should be. That's what Thanksgiving is about. Having beers, watching sport, watching football, hanging out with family. Awesome.
And you know, there's a lot going on because my son's school, UCF, is doing so well this year in the standings. They were like 0-12 2 years ago, and this year it came back, did some great work. Anyway, let's talk about some of the things that happened. Last week was a pretty amazing week in the markets. So we saw the Dow Jones Industrial Average up about 675 points, or about 2.8%. S&P was up 42 points, about 1.6%. NASDAQ, the NASDAQ 100 was actually down for the week. And then we had Friday. So let's talk a little bit of what's happening. I mean, is this all about, you know, the tax? We'll get to the tax discussion in a minute, but is this pretty much all about the taxes, or is this an exhaustion gasp finally moving higher? Is it, what's going on?
I don't know. I don't think people need us anymore. They should just buy stocks. Yeah, we can end the podcast right now.
Buy the index, be done with it.
It's, you know what it is? I think it's like a final push higher. And yes, you're seeing good news on taxes. You're seeing good news across the board. But what you have to realize is even in late 2006, going into 2007, you know, before these things turn, I'm not saying we're going to crash, but I think everybody knows we really do for a pullback. I mean, it's one of the longest bull markets we've ever been in, guys. I mean, it's been 7-8 years. Pullbacks are healthy, especially if you're prepared, you have money on the sidelines. You're wondering why so many money managers and hedge funds are outperforming or underperforming is because in order to outperform, you really have to buy risky stocks, and the risk reward might not be there. I mean, you have to buy Amazon at 1,000 and it goes to, you know, 1150, a little bit higher, almost 1200. You're buying the Facebooks and these things inflated. I mean, you're buying them at 165 to go to 180, but you're taking on an excessive amount of risk right now to generate small profits because I think those profits are getting smaller and smaller. But look, everything underlying is very good right now. You can go to the economy is good, the consumer spending, retail sales, You can go down the line. I know you follow every one of these indexes and indicators for the economy. Earnings are really strong, but usually, like we saw in 2007, yeah, these things can roll over really quick. And I think we're going to see a little bit of that in terms of not only on the economic front, but also on the stock front, where these things, some of these stocks are really getting out of hand right now, where it's getting to levels where it just doesn't make sense to purchase them. And they'll go up another 15%, 20% from when I thought they were like insane to buy.
So let's talk about that. But you mentioned economics. So let's talk about that for a second here. So we look at the economics for last week, okay? And then we'll talk about what's happening on a global basis as well. But I mean, there's not much going wrong. I mean, I don't think I could put my finger on anything that's like, oh, that's a problem. As a matter of fact, I put a table there for you. You got that table, right? So what do we got? Housing numbers look good. Consumer confidence looks good. GDP ticked higher to 3.3%. Inflation is subdued. Personal income is better. Spending's a little bit light. Manufacturing numbers domestically and internationally look good. And you go down the list, for example, of last week. So let's kind of go down this one by one. So we have new home sales, right? 685,000 on annualized basis. No, nice number. I mean, prior was 645. We see some more things that are important, right? We see advanced wholesale inventories, a little bit light, but still okay in the trend. Case-Shiller Housing Price Index up 6.2% for the month. 22%, this is interesting, 22% over the last year. Now, what do you make of that, by the way?
You know, even almost every single economic indicator that you, I mean, you could almost go down the line because, yeah, I have the chart in front of me, but every, you know, even job numbers, PCE prices, ISM index, 58. Remember that was below 50 for such a long time.
Yep.
But, you know, even auto sales, you know, but when I look at this, I see a lot of things that could be rolling, especially auto sales, truck sales. I think that market, they're in a lot of trouble there. That I see a lot of, you know, I have a great analyst we just hired, Michael Alkin, who's really deep involved in this trend and some of the things that he's been showing me. And you know, he's an ex-hedge fund guy for 20 years. That's something I think is really, really going to roll over the next few years. And you're seeing it already, but the stock, but it's amazing what we're seeing right here. And I'm going to go into the economy and into stocks here, right here to give you an example where, say you take the macro view, which we're looking at right now, right, with the economy, with economic stuff, right? And then you say, how does that impact stocks? Well, you're looking, take oil prices, right? Which, mm-hmm. you know, we have nothing on here. Oil is up. How much? I thought I made the most brilliant call ever. It was at 42, 43. Laid out this whole argument, well, oil prices are not going to go below 40. They're going to go a lot higher to 60. And when I made the call at the time, everyone was very bearish. Because every time I go below 40, the rig counts come down tremendously. You can't really produce at scale. You can't produce oil under 40, especially in America, any place. Yeah, certain areas within the Permian Basin, which I visited, yes. But most areas, 95% of the areas, you can't. So oil prices went up. And what happened to oil stocks? And we're looking at 20% rise in oil prices, and oil stocks were down before this latest move with Russia coming to the table and agreeing with OPEC cuts, which was last week. We're looking at oil stocks down 15% while the underlying commodity is up 20%. We're looking at gold prices going higher and gold stocks still getting nailed. So we're seeing a lot of disconnects in the market right now. And even auto, I'm looking at the underlying trends in auto sales, how most of them are coming down. Yet you see GM, you see a lot of stocks doing fantastic. So I'm not seeing it translate to this. It is going to, but there's a lot of disconnects in the market, which I, to be honest with you, someone's been in this market for 20 years. I find it difficult to explain, to understand, but I think that's going to change. And you're seeing oil stocks starting to rise now that the OPEC, you know, cuts are official. They're going to keep them for, you know, until next year or whatever, for another 6, 9, 12 months, whatever. But I think you're going to see that also with value stocks as well. You're going to see a lot of money come in there, but it's weird when you're looking at the macro and looking at the, you know, the underlying stocks. It's not in sync right now, and you're not used to seeing that, which is really difficult for the average analyst to see why that's taking place.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned value stocks, by the way, and the disconnect, because value versus growth on a small to a mid to a large cap basis on the last, let's call it 12 months at least, value has lagged dramatically across all sizes. Value stocks, which are more, let's call them the energy related and staples, versus growth, which is your technology and your healthcare, values like utilities, lagging tremendously.
Tremendously, you know, is not even a good enough word.
Yeah, I know.
For
it's ridiculous numbers.
I mean, I've seen stocks that I recommended that were down from, I mean, let's take one stock, for example, which is Diebold. Diebold is a stock I followed for a very long time. We did well for a while, and then I missed a couple of times. So now, staying away from the stock, and you're looking at the past like year and a half, 2 years, I think it was around 40, came all the way down to 20. I was like, this is a joke, right? So ATM manufacturer, don't think ATM's like, you know, cash, no one's taking cash. It's all cloud computed, big data analytics, and almost every bank in the world needs to upgrade their branches right now. It's very, very important to get up to digitalize their branches. They have the contract signed already. So what the banks are doing is they have this money in their backlog. So they sign 100% of all client, every single person that they have re-up there. So 100% renewal rate. They have guaranteed fixed contracts. So they got that revenue coming in. And yet the banks are delaying, waiting to see what's going on with taxes and deregulation. So you have a little bit of delay. That's why the stock went from 4 to 20, because they also took over another company, became the largest in their industry. It's a $60 billion industry.
It went from 40 to 20 or 4 to 20?
Yeah, so then you look
back up.
It went from 40 to 20,
40
right?
to 20, got cut in half. All right, go ahead.
Yes, it got cut in half. And then you look at it, and insiders are buying, looks great. Went from 20 to 16. No news, no nothing, to 16. I'm like, how the hell? Like, I'll give you
my 2 cents. You want my 2 cents?
But really quick. So 20 to 16, then what happened? You had someone step in and say, look, this is a joke. You should be buying 20% of the shares outstanding. Their revenue and earnings are going to increase dramatically. So you're looking at a company trading at its lowest PE in almost the history of this company. This is a 150-year-old company. It pays a solid dividend, but nobody wants these types of names. So, yeah, you can give me your 2 cents.
I'll give you my 2 cents just from a theory on Diebold, because I've looked at this before and I considered actually shorting it. And the reason was based on a thesis rather than looking at all the fundamentals. And again, I didn't look any further because I kind of stopped there. I said, you know, we'll see how this plays out. I was obviously wrong. You were obviously wrong, but that's okay. Now, the idea is that you have a lot of alternatives to ATMs, right? Two things. First, you have this whole concept around the world that this discussion about banning cash. Is that going to happen? I don't know. Probably not. The second thing is I do wonder what the long-term trajectory of ATM use is going to be that is that will have fees on the ATM transaction, okay? Because me personally, I always go to, let's say, my bank. Or you could use something like Schwab. If you use like a Schwab card, for example, you could use any ATM anywhere and they'll refund back the fees. But I was wondering, you know, if all these people and me, myself as well, we're using these various apps, whether it's a Venmo, whether it's a PayPal, a Square, whether it's some other kind of virtual payment, or for example, the Zelle app that's now built, the Zelle component that's built into a lot of banking apps, where you can just transfer money all around very easily, will ATM usage keep moving? And obviously they don't make necessarily money on the usage, the bank does, right? However, what is the impetus for banks to really keep on expanding their ATM network with the thought that maybe people aren't using them as much?
It's not expanding. It's more of a recycle. So you have very old ATMs where if you notice that the new ones where you could deposit checks, they read them right away and then go right in where you don't have to, you know, go into the branches anymore. There's like 60, 70% of these that aren't even updated. Not only that, it's not just about the hardware, which I think people are looking at. It's more that every ATM, you need every single branches are never going to go away. You're going to need them. Yes, you're seeing more, like, believe it or not, most people still use cash, all right? Even though people say, well, we have ATMs and debit cards. I mean, cash is still the main currency. So by a mile. So that's not going away. Is it slowing? Yeah, it's slowed. And that's what it's, you know, reflected in a lot of the numbers of what's going on with Diebold. But the fact that all these branches need to upgrade those, you need to have those ATMs. And not only that, you need to have the big data analytics behind it, the cloud computing behind it, the storage behind it. None of that is available at branches where you're monitoring, you're looking at different trends and you know, everything's like that with Facebook, everything's like that with Amazon right now. But when you look at that trend and you look at the underlying fundamentals and you're seeing a stock down 60, 70% from its highs, a lot of that is really factored in. And this is money that they already have in their backlog.
So where's the stock now? Where's the stock now?
The stock is around 19. It came back. That's the point I was making. So it went down to 16. And if you notice, the past two weeks, we've seen, at least I've seen on my end, someone who's following small caps as well, a massive amount of money pushing into value stocks right now. Look at the department store retailers. Look at oil. You know, you're seeing companies even like Diebold, where as soon as technology, especially over the past couple of days that got hit, but even a little bit before that, you're seeing a massive rotation where I've never been a market where it seems like everything is up because the averages are higher. But to be honest with you, when you look at the underlying fundamentals, even in the Russell, there's more stocks, at least this is when I screened them 3 weeks ago, there was more stocks that were down this year than up. Well, think about that. It should be 80%. I would think 75-80%. Not only that, really quick here, another trend I saw, which I thought was amazing, which I've never seen in my 20 years analyzing this stuff, is the top 50 stocks in the Russell, the top performers this year, there was two or three that actually generate earnings and like less than 10% that generate revenue. So in order for you to outperform, you really have to buy stocks that aren't producing earnings, that aren't really generating revenue. So that's the kind of risk you have to take in order to outperform this market. And I can tell you, as we saw in the last, just the last couple of days, when that switch and that momentum light goes from on to off, these things fall 10, 15%.
Yeah. You know, it's
like immediately.
But like last week, for example, there was a day, I mean, Facebook was down 4%. Now that may seem like a lot for a technology and you know, kind of the name like that, that has such a ride that it's had over the last, however long, but 4% on Facebook is a pretty significant number. And I think that was Wednesday or Thursday of last week. Like you said, the algos just switched off. And that's the other thing, by the way. One of the reasons why, in my opinion, at least that what I see and what I hear and when I talk to other people in the trading world, the whole market, it's a giant rotation that's going on. And what we've seen is that market indices themselves are held up. Don't forget, these algos are programmed in such a way. Why is it that on most days the market kind of maybe dips down or goes up and then comes back to the zero line? It kind of sticks there like all day and then it ramps up or comes down a little bit towards the end. You have a constant bid and selling going on by these algos that are trained to watch the big picture and make sure nothing falls out of bed so it doesn't look like there's a problem so they could trade underneath all this. It's a lot of machines that are doing this work right now. Now, this is not a conspiracy theory. It's fact. We know this is going on. We know this is going on. And different than in years past where you would have maybe people being skeptical about markets and maybe not putting money in, whatever. They have the ability to transfer from various components of the market to other areas, this rotation that goes on a daily, minute-by-minute basis, and keep things up and doing well potentially, but have a lot of things underneath maybe not. And then they'll rotate it back and they'll keep some of the big names up because these market indices are cap-weighted, for example. You know, we saw that a lot on Friday. A great example of this when the news comes out about Michael Flynn and his guilty plea and markets dropped, I mean, 350 points on the Dow. Do you think there are a lot of people just saying, oh my God, take all my money out of the market at this point? Or was it algos that were driving all this? Right?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that, you know, that's one of the biggest risks to the market right now because we know when something, you know, think of the housing crisis, right? We all know the story now, what happened. But what blew the housing crisis is CDOs are not a bad vehicle, right? We made them into terrible things, right? A lot of debt obligations and you know, all these exotic products. But what happens is they work. We pool these pooling loans together, prime assets together, and then creating like, to try to create a higher interest rate. It's, you know, it makes sense because prime people, but then when you get into subprime, then all of a sudden it gets into synthetics of synthetics of synthetics and you blow up this market and, you know, every loan that you produce is going to be bought by the government. So you're just selling, you know, 20 loans to a stripper like, you know, you saw in the Big Short, right? Mm-hmm. And she has like six houses. In this market, algorithms are working so well that you're seeing more and more. It's not just the Renaissance Capitals, which is the largest hedge fund in the world. You're seeing more and more, right? So when something works, you see everybody keep pouring into it. But what I'm seeing in the underlying trends, I know you're seeing it as well. When a stock misses earnings, I think they should be down like 5 or 6%. And they'll open up 5, 6%. For some reason, I won't look at the stock to the end of the day, and it's down like 22%.
But on the other hand, on the upside too,
yeah. Like you'll see a stock open up 3-4%. I'm like, wow, and we had a couple of those stocks. We had a company called MindBody, which was up like 3-4%. It went up 18%, 17% by the end of the day. So the algo, it's they're seeing the trades in the market. They're able to trigger this. This is done, guys. I'm going to tell you a story, and this is worth telling you, right? So this is when I worked for Cramer in 2008, 2006, 7, 8, 9. When Cramer used to come out with his recommendations, so the email used to hit, right? And there was a whole bunch of different lists. So maybe it was like maybe 5 seconds off on some list, you know, not on purpose, just a matter of how it went out through what ISP you're using. Before I even got the email, like 2 seconds before the trading, it would be hundreds of thousands of shares were trading immediately. So they would be able to get this alert. I don't even know how they did it because you think you'd have to read it first. So as they're sending the alert, 3 seconds before I would get an email sometimes, you'd see 100, 2, 3, 4, 5, 500,000 shares trading of the stock that they recommended because Jim Cramer is so bad. That's how fast the algorithms worked, and we're looking at 2006, 2007. Today, it is so fast. There's no thinking. There's no fundamentals. It's trading. It's all algos. And more people are getting into this system where what happens when it fails? That's what that's one of my biggest fears in the market. What happens
What would make it fail?
Just the if the latest flash crashes. Say if something doesn't work and they all pull their system at the same time without getting killed, whatever it is. Say you have algos creating a system, certain buy order. Say if you just take all of that out of the market, like how does the market have a flash crash? How do we go down 1,000, 2,000 points in a day? And then you'll see a company like Verizon, whatever it was trading at 35, go to 26 and then go back up to, 34 in 45 seconds. Where if you had buy orders in there, you got triggered. You got you're up like 40, 50%, 30% of the stock. How do you explain flash crashes and how that happened? How do you think that happens?
No, obviously it's all computer driven and it's errors possibly on some servers. But that's a problem. But still, even with all these problems at the end of it, and let's call Friday's action of that 350-point drop was met in almost within 15 minutes. People like, okay, that's good. Let's just drive it back up. Drove it back up till the Dow closed down only 40 points by the end of the day. Now, some people are saying, well, it was the Flynn news that came out. Plus, there were some other things around the world that were going on. But there was the Flynn news that came out. And then on top of that, a few minutes later, we saw that there was a discussion by McConnell from the Senate saying, well, I think we have the votes for the tax bill. And that just drove everything right back up. But still, everybody thought that they had the votes for the tax bill to begin with. This was new news on the Flynn front. So the question is, is it just the tape reading algos that are just blowing things out, looking two things? Well, it's down 350. Might as well buy it because in the last few years, any dip has been bought. And the corrections that you're talking about, the flash crashes, definitely reverberated in markets and investors for a number of days, maybe even weeks. But after that, everybody's like, all right, it was a glitch. Who cares? This buyer's coming in. Let's just kind of keep driving it up. I mean, are the fundamentals good?
It doesn't matter. Fundamentals don't matter. This is what I'm trying to explain with the algos, where the Flynn news 15 years ago would have pushed the market down, say if the markets were at the same levels, right? And we won't use percentages here, but because I don't know how much 350 points of percentage now, because the market goes up every day. It's like 0%, 0.1 nowadays. It's up so high. But seriously. So say, it was at the same levels, like 15 years ago, the Flynn news would have pushed the markets down 100, 125 points. Now it goes down 350. A stock comes out with decent news and goes up. It starts going up 3-4%. Next thing you know, it finishes up 17%.
Yeah.
Same thing on the down. So what it's doing is it's accelerating the news, and it's almost like people are getting I didn't see these trends over the past few years. I just started seeing it this year, especially late in the year, where I'm like, oh, well, one of my companies didn't report good earnings. It wasn't really. like JCPenney, for example. JCPenney came out, the stock went down from 10 to 320. I thought it was a fantastic buy. They came out and warned. Basically, they said, look, all right, we're just going to announce we're going to close these stores. We're just going to do it at once, get everything off because everything else is going good. Our inventory levels are low. The stock went down like 30% in one day. It went down like 250, 240. Then you had some idiot from Citi that said, oh, it's going to 150 to get on TV, and he got on TV. And what happened is they just basically, if you look at the underlying fundamentals of what they said that quarter, it was all factored in. They closed the stores. They're better positioned now for the holiday season than they've been the past 10 years. It's a company that they do own their real estate. They are generating free cash flow. They're going to generate earnings. Seeing that stock fall an extra 30%. And what happened within 2 weeks later, it's trading at 330, 340 from 250.
Right. I mean, that's the other thing.
It's unbelievable when you see these trends. It's like nobody cares. It's not fundamentals. People didn't push it down. They were like, wow, this stock should have been down maybe 5% and say, no, let's wait and see. Now they warned, they brought down. But all this should have been factored in, yet the stock was able to come down 30% in one day. And then it came back during the day, went down like 13, 14%. Now it's all the way, 250 to 330, 340 is a major move in like a week, 2 weeks. But that's where you're seeing the volatility where individual investors, holy cow, man, this is one of the toughest markets that I've ever been in my life.
I think what's happening is the algos, there must be an algo out there called pain point, the pain point algo. Find where those pain points are, because the algos have technically an unlimited amount of money that they could trade, right? So they find the pain point, they blast through either the up or the down, depending on, the short side, and they squeeze it higher, or the downside, and they take it lower. And then what happens is they say, well, we just took it all the way down at this point, we flushed everybody out. And you notice when you see the after that drop, oftentimes, I can't tell you how many times over the last year I've seen stocks miss their numbers and get hurt for a few days. and then maybe 3 or 4 days start to climb. And then by the time the next quarterly earnings call comes out, they're pretty much back up to where they were the past quarter before the news came out. And then they'll decide on what happens at that point moving from there. But I think the pain point algo is actually looking for these levels and really trying to sniff out where people would just say, forget it, I'm done, and then just blow it out on the short side or on the long side. And I agree with you that it is a problem because fundamentals don't matter on both sides at this point. You have momentum traders also just blasting things up. I mean, you see how many stocks, almost on a daily basis, you have a few stocks that are up over 100%. Some small, low float name that just cranks up. It may be up 50% pre-market. By the end of the day, it's up 100%, 200%. You know, Diana Container Ships did that recently, all the different top ships. And then they just fall down the next few days.
But even a good example of what we're talking about here, guys, and look, you know, we're not complaining about the system. I think, you know, it sounds like, you know, oh, you know, it's not working. It's we're trying to figure it out this way we can give better advice to everyone that's listening to us, right? So we both have big followings. NVIDIA is a great example. So NVIDIA, not this quarter, last quarter, they missed estimates. They didn't meet estimates, right? So the estimates were inflated. The stock was, you know, just a huge high flyer, right? Everybody knows NVIDIA, it's through the roof. So it went from like 180 to like 170, right? So it pulled back. It went from almost like 188 to 170. Now the stock started picking up steam because all of a sudden they said, well, we're starting to get cryptocurrency business. Now, all you have to do is put crypto in your name. And this is normal, right? We've seen it during .com. People putting .com at the end of their company, even though they didn't even have a website. Uranium, believe it or not, uranium at one time, people were putting the word uranium in their name because uranium prices were, you know, 120, 130 in 2007. So then the cryptocurrency thing came in. And then all of a sudden, you saw NVIDIA go from 170 to 200 out of nowhere going into the current quarter. They basically beat earnings pretty good. And they said, well, cryptocurrency revenue is down. And not only did NVIDIA say that, but AMD, because they're no longer a cryptocurrency place, right? They don't have the right technology. They did have it, but you need so much advanced technology. It's not there. They're using other companies now. They're seeing that decline. It didn't decline at all. It went up 30 points from cryptocurrency after missing a quarter. But then they report and they say, well, our earnings are pretty good. But, you know, we're not – cryptocurrency is going lower, and yet it kept that premium. And it went to 210, 215. Now it's starting to pull back sharply. It's below 200. But it's just, you know, when you see things like that, you're able to forecast and say, that was one of the things I saw analyzing the cryptocurrency boom, where AMD and NVIDIA are not plays on this. They were plays and no longer plays. So should they keep the 20% premium that they gain? Don't you think they should lose that? And they're not losing it. So it is a lot of things that just don't make sense in the market that you have to be very careful.
I think there's also a lot of people not selling. Listen, when you have all the here's the other part and the component to all this. It's the mad dash and the change in investor mentality in terms of what do I want to do here? Do I want to invest in individual stocks that have that kind of movement? And I don't really understand a lot of the fundamentals. And I think a lot of people also have a hard time. And listen, there's a lot smarter people that are producing the balance sheets and the financials for the companies, right? With all the various footnotes and all the various moving this to this quarter, this to that quarter, moving this to this line, moving that to that line, then you and I combined, all right? We know that. They're smart. Very difficult a lot of times to figure out exactly what's going on with a company on a quarter-to-quarter basis or on a snapshot basis. Trending is a different story. You can definitely check out what's going on trending. But the thing is that a lot of people said, you know what, I'm just going to invest in an ETF. And there's an ETF for everything. As a matter of fact, I saw last week there's a brand new ETF did you know this? For big box retail stores. Are you aware of this?
No, I wasn't.
The symbol, there's two of them. There's one, it's actually designed to short the big box retail stores, okay? And there's one of them that is designed to go long the retail that's online. The symbol for the short big box retail ETF is EMTY, empty.
Love it.
And the other one is, I think, CLIK, click. That's for the online retailers, long. So what's interesting, when it first came out, the day it came out is when everything started turning around. It all turned. But anyway, the thing is that where was I going with this? Oh, there's an ETF for everything. There's an index base for anything. And people are saying, you know what, with the indices doing so well, I'll just buy the broad-based index. And therefore, what's happening is people aren't necessarily selling. They're not selling. So now all these stocks get an underlying bid from all these people buying the ETFs, and there's massive inflows, and has been for some time, in ETFs, not to mention some of these other platforms that are just doing regular rebalancing into these things on an ongoing basis and a dollar cost averaging into this. So I think some of this is also caused by the fact that there's just a constant flow of money. Money's cheap. There's a lot of liquidity out there. And that's what's happening. And we see this on a global basis, that we have an amazing amount of liquidity that's being formulated by the central banks around the world. Even though we have a 4.1% unemployment rate in manufacturing doing well, and we see that inflation is creeping towards 2%, but not much over. Spending is up, retail sales up, and we see all these good things happening. We see housing prices up 22% over a year. Yet the central banks are like, well, I don't know if we're going to raise that much. It will be very slow. We're not really going to undo our balance sheets. We are still in financial crisis levels for Fed funds and for the amount of money that is being spent on quantitative easing. Do you disagree?
Yeah. You know what it is? When inflation comes, it's like a, you know, picture a train that you're pushing and you're waiting to get downhill, and you keep, and that's where we've been, right? So we've seen where, you know, you could argue with the metric that the Fed uses, right? The CPI is, you know, we're looking, that's what when Andrew was talking about, you know, 2%, we're getting close to 2%, because the Fed came out and said, well, 2%, once we get 2%, we're going to start raising, and they're starting to raise before that. It's remarkable how much money was added to this system. It's remarkable what interest rates are, how many companies are borrowing, that we're not really seeing it. But you know what? From a CPI standpoint, we're not seeing it, but we are seeing it in some industries. We're seeing it in some industries compared to others. Maybe, you know, some things where, you know, energy has come down. Yeah, but look at healthcare costs. Look at education costs. I mean, through the roof. So it's not impacting everything. And of course, the CPI, you know, they scale it down and say, well, what about energy and food? Oh, great. You know, that's awesome. Because what do we use the most? Yeah. Energy and food. But without energy and food, we're okay. Okay, that's the thing that everyone in the world has to use. It's a necessity. That should be included. So when you look at this, and one thing you should be aware of when everyone's saying the stock market is, you know, overvalued and it's crazy, they're doing everything they can to get inflation at over 2%. It hasn't happened. But when it does happen, it's like that train starts going downhill and you can't stop it. So if that happens, you're probably going to see, we could see a market go much higher before it goes lower. That's a possibility. You know, even though people have been saying this market's going to crash for the last 3, 4, 5 years, it's been going higher. But with this kind of policy in place, where we still have super low interest rates, it's so easy to get money. Now we have lower taxes. You're forcing people who usually are supposed to be conservative and retirees, forcing them to get into the market. You got to get out of savings. You got to spend your money. You got to put them in different vehicles. That could result, and we've seen over the past couple of years, going higher. But it's just the policy that we have right now, interest rates should be much, much higher, and they're not. And if we do hit that inflation and all of a sudden you say, well, wow, we fell like at 2%, it can go to 2.5% in months before you know it. And that's not going to be a good thing for the market.
And by the way, I think the forcing word is a little bit subdued. I think screwing them is a better way to describe what's being happening to the savers, for the people.
It depends how you describe screw, because if screwing is, hey, you should have took your money out and put it in the market, they wouldn't have been screwed if they did that.
Correct. No, if they did. But you know what? At the same time, listen, there's nothing wrong with being conservatively minded in terms of your investment process and not desiring. There is no law that says you have to be in the stock market. So if you were an elderly person that was living fine on your Social Security, your pension, and your savings, and you had it in a bank or you had it in some bonds, okay, and you were living just everything's great, everything's fine. I'm getting my senior citizen discounts at the movies. I'm going to, you know, the buffet early birds. I'm doing fine, or whatever, or even if you have a lot of money. But these days, that no longer creates enough of an income in order to pay for these things. And so what do? You have a couple of choices. You scale back, or you go into the markets, which may be against your personal ability, your risk tolerance levels, and you just deal with it. So you're every day wondering, oh my gosh, what's going to happen if the market falls down? Am I going to be in trouble? Am I going to all of a sudden have a situation where I can't afford things anymore? I have clients that don't want to be aggressive. So they're on the much more conservative, ultra conservative side of our portfolios. And let's say we have a 30% allocation towards equities for them. Okay. They're comfortable with that. They can deal with that. They know that if the market falls down 10%, they're going to take a 3% hit, approximately on their equity exposure. However, I've tried to talk to them about, for example, we said, listen, you know what? One area that is something that we'd like as an example is the international area. I can't tell you, I've had this client for 25 years. And every time I bring up the word international, I see them tense up. And they're like, well, so I said, listen, it's because I don't think you understand it. We talked about it. So a few years ago, we got them to move over to some international investments and they're fine with it. But I got to tell you something. Every time I talk to them, like, how's the international stuff doing? Are we losing money? Are we making money? And it's just a different mentality. It's just, you know, but so I want to make sure everybody's listening, understands that you don't have to be in the market. You don't have to own Bitcoin. You don't have to be in anything. You do what makes you comfortable and what's right for you for your future. Now, at the same time, don't let your emotions overtake you when you're making these decisions. Make sure you're using some reasonable logic to make sure that your portfolio, your family, your finances are set up in a way that is the most prudent for you for the future in all sorts of realms. So don't just get out because you think you're just, you know, going to be smarter than anybody else and get out of the market. So many people do that, or try to just necessarily time 100% in, 100% out. It's okay to get out for a while, but you know, if things go against you and as things keep moving up, it's okay to get back in as well. You could always get back out again. Hey, I want to turn this discussion for a second back to the economics for a minute. I want to talk about global investing for a second. Okay. Can we do that?
Absolutely.
I'm not boring you, am I?
Oh, I just woke up. I'm good now.
All right. Get some coffee in you. All right. Global PMIs. This is the manufacturing numbers around the world. And I want to kind of give you a 17. I'll put these charts. I got some charts and tables that I will put on this episode, episode number 537 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And of course, you can go over to CurzioResearch.com and check out all the great offerings. Frank has great newsletters, unbelievable newsletters. And you can find out some of his research that's really very cool. I encourage you to do that, especially going into, you know, the new year when it's kind of like, oh, what can I do to increase my opportunities? And you got to check out Frank's newsletters. Anyway, I want to talk about global PMI. So we'll have this. There's a chart here that we put together, which is a 17 non-US country average PMI. So we averaged this PMIs, got some help from briefing.com on this and looked at this. Now, you can see this trend. I mean, since the beginning of the year and late part of last year, the trends on a global basis have been doing really well. And the latest number, so we went from 53.32 back last December, we're at 56.38 with probably the biggest spike on a monthly basis from the previous month that we've seen. That's pretty good, right?
It is good. And it just shows you that, you know, even when you look at Europe and other countries, they were behind the curve. And I don't know if I should say behind the curve, but they were behind us. I don't know if there is a curve for something like this when it comes to you know, fueling their system, stimulating the economy, lower interest rates, doing all this stuff, you know, strengthen their banking systems. So remember that European crisis happened after us, mostly after us. And then you're seeing a lot of these things build up where they're seeing the formula that works for now, right? Because this could end in a total disaster. Right now it's working to the point, okay, let's inflate it. Let's throw money at the markets. Let's, you know, print an unlimited amount of money. Let's, you know, make sure backstop all the bad stuff that's on the bank's balance sheets and let them take on even more risk, right? That's what we were doing early on, 2010, 2011. Yep. So now we're seeing that, and you're looking at these PMI numbers, and you know, you have 17 non-US country, and this is the average. I mean, guys, that's a huge number, 56. I mean, 53 to 56 may not seem that big. That's a monster number when it comes to this index. And it just shows that this is showing inflation across the world. I mean, we don't really have as much, but this is showing inflation across the world, but it also shows you that these economies are bouncing back and doing better right now. But remember, it doesn't mean this is an indication. These are lagging indicators. Okay, this is all lagging. So you wonder why in 2007, early 2007, you could probably compare today's numbers to then, if I had to guess. Maybe a little bit earlier, but 2007. And it's amazing because when we got to 2008, 2009, what happens? Those numbers are revised, and I want to say, well, you know, they came back and said, well, in 2007, we were really in a recession. It doesn't feel like a recession right now, right? But 2 years from now when they revise it. So you have to be careful. A lot of this stuff is lagging. It's reflecting what's going on over the past 3-6 months. I mean, they say 3 months, but it gets, even GDP, how many times it gets revised? At least three times, right?
Yep. Besides final comes out, yeah.
Yeah, so you have the number and the whole market trades on that. Even when it gets revised lower, the market doesn't really trade on those revisions, though, right? Often, but not compared to that headline.
Well, not
number.
Today, because the data doesn't matter. That's the difference, you know, because right now things are just okay. You know, things are good. Things are generally good. So everybody's like, well, one little number here, one little number there. But one of the things that stuck out to me about the global PMIs that really I thought was the most interesting was even with a weak U.S. dollar, which you would think should, in fact, not help some of these countries in EM and countries around the world in terms of their manufacturing because it's harder for us to buy their products. Even with a weak U.S. dollar that we've seen all year, down about, what, 7 or 8%, recently tried to move higher, broke its mini uptrend, and rolled back over, by the way. Even with that, there is a good amount of PMI improvement. So that means that the countries are actually able to have their economies and manufacturing growing internally rather than relying on external. And that's actually a good thing, and I'm pleased about that. I don't know what will happen if the dollar turns higher. I don't know if it's going to benefit them. I don't know if it's all just a massive amount of a confidence game or of confidence that's high. We'll see. But let's
in these
go.
Markets, Andrew, real quick, as much as we're you know, I mean, probably 90% of the people listen to this and even 90% of money managers because they focus on the U.S., the international markets have been outperforming us.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it's interesting when you look at that trend.
Yeah, especially Europe. Europe has been on fire. Our positions in European sectors are up, I don't know, you know, 28, 32% this year. Emerging markets just blowing the doors off. Even the emerging market bonds and even our EM, our foreign bonds are doing really well. So, I mean, definitely a big component to performance this year and outperformance. Let's bring it on all the way around here to the idea of tax plan. We saw that in the wee hours of the morning on Friday night into Saturday, the Republicans and not the Democrats passed the bill 49 to 51, slim majority. But that's all they need here in the Senate to pass the tax bill. They cobbled together a lot of amendments at the last minute. A lot of them were handwritten. A lot of them were done behind closed doors. The Democrats got the bill about an hour and a half, 2 hours or so before the vote. And that was the final vote with amendments and changes and handwritten stuff. What is your thought on this whole thing? Now, let me just state this one point here. That if you look at the table that I put together here, we did this mid last week. And we wanted to find the average effective tax rate for S&P 500 companies. So we went out and I gathered all the data. We did the analysis. We came out that the S&P 500 companies right now, looking back at their most recent four quarters and year, have an average annual effective tax rate of 21.2. So in theory, if, you know, they're still vacillating between somehow, I don't know how they did this, but they're still thinking, well, we may change it because they have to go through the reconciliation process with the House. They're right now at 20%. They're talking about maybe 22%, but is that really going to create $8 to $10 of additional S&P earnings next year, this tax plan?
Yeah, it will. It's not really an apples-to-apples comparison because what you're seeing at that 21% tax rate is all financial manipulation, right? I mean, they're doing everything they can, using money for buybacks, taking more money. Look at Amazon. If Amazon's tax rate was 20%, their earnings would be incredibly higher. Instead, what they like to do, and they're the best in the world at doing this along with Facebook, is reinvesting that capital. So would they put more on the bottom line and invest more? You know, is it, you know, spending more money and saying, don't worry, earnings will come around? But when you're looking at that 21.2%, you're seeing a lot of financial manipulation to get that, whether that's, you know, offshore profits, whether that's, you know, buybacks or you know, increasing your dividend or whatever it is. I think when we lower the tax rates, it's going to be a more pure number. I think they'll put more stuff to the bottom line because, look, guys, when you own a company, think about it. Like IBM has revenue coming in like crazy. Any company has revenue coming in like crazy. Say if someone like a defense company signs, you know, a $300 billion contract, $100 billion contract, you know, when do they recognize that revenue? Well, they're probably going to wait a long time until hopefully taxes changes. And now the taxes, why would you recognize it, you know, in the last 3 years when you could recognize over the next 5 or 7 years mm-hmm. when you could have a much lower tax rate? So it might not be the apples to apples comparison, and it is a big deal, but the repatriation is going to be really huge as well. I mean, there's a lot of money overseas. And look, they say it's around $2 trillion, a little more than that. Apple has, I think, 90% of their cash overseas. It doesn't mean they're going to take all that cash and bring it here. But a lot of that cash is probably going to go to buybacks, even though we want it to go to spending.
The company said that.
So and when it goes to buybacks and lowers those counts, look, this is very important for you guys to understand. don't get ticked off. Just like when it's how do you make money off this? So, for example, and I hate to bring up an example this extreme, but I need to do it to prove a point to investors here, where my dad passed away from cancer due to smoking. It shouldn't mean that for me, I'm not recommending if I think it's a great stock or if, you know, tobacco companies are a great buy, I shouldn't recommend them. That's an extreme example. But a lot of people looked at the financial crisis, said, I hate the government. I can't believe they're bailing out the banks. And you should have looked at it and said, listen, everything in the entire world is going to go higher. They're doing everything they can to inflate the market, and they're backstopping everything the banks did. The banks are better buys today than they've ever been. Instead, you had so many people complaining. So when it comes to things like this, you're looking at buybacks saying, I throw this money, you know, it's going to create more jobs. It's not going to create more jobs for the U.S., but what it's going to do is it's going to mean that these earnings are going to go higher because they're buying back their stock, and their stock prices are probably going to go even higher. Play it from that point of view and try to be objective to that point where it's, you know, hey, you don't like it. You don't like what's going on, but that move is going to be really good for the companies who have the most money overseas because they're going to buy back their stock and their earnings are going to go higher. We know that stocks usually move higher as their earnings go higher.
Well, at least there's a floor under them. But is there any care we have at all about the $1.5 trillion? And this all depends on this dynamic scoring. But do we care about the $1.5 trillion? We don't care.
We don't care about that. You know why we don't care about that? Because that's not today. That's not today. Right, that's not tomorrow. That's not next year. That's not 5 years from now. So we don't care about it. Nobody cares. If think about this, Andrew, and I know you've had a company that came out, and I've had companies that come out, and they said, you know what, we didn't recognize as much revenue as we thought in the first quarter. We're going to recognize in the second half of the year.
Right.
That stock's going to get destroyed.
Yep.
It turns out to be a fantastic buying opportunity if the management is true and they're not lying. People don't care about 6 months or 12 months from now. They care about what's going to happen tomorrow, and your stock's going to get destroyed. If you just push out any revenue or any earnings, even as far as 3 months, what I'm seeing, your stock's going to get destroyed. Nobody cares, which usually creates a good buying opportunity for you guys. If you don't own the stock and you see a stock like JCPenney go down at 250 on news that should have been factored in, and then you know, you're looking at a 30, 40% increase in the stock in a matter of weeks.
So you think the tax bill overall is going to be a net positive potentially?
Oh, yeah. It's going to be a positive for the market.
Is it going to be
absolutely
more positive than we've already seen? Is some of this baked in?
No. I think a lot of it's baked in. Yeah, a lot of it's baked in with the markets. But yeah, we're seeing, and I think a lot of that is factored in right now. I don't think deregulation is factored in, which we really need to see. I mean, that's why the banks are so big. They're forced to keep all this capital on their balance sheets. You know, let's lend it out. For me, I had a look. When we started our business in November, we did very well with our launch, right? It became a real company overnight. And so many things happened where, you know, we used to, oh, okay, we're going to use this guy. Here's a check for $500. Everything's got to get recorded. It's a real business now. So we had to delay our taxes to make sure everything's right because now it's Kersey Research, a legit business. So the fact that I didn't have my taxes done, I recently purchased a house. My mom moved down here. I had enough cash and not it's Florida. Don't think like I'm a billionaire or anything.
Yeah, it was a $500 million house. Yeah, $500 million.
Yeah, don't think that. But they wouldn't give me a mortgage. I show them in my account that I had pretty much 7-8 times the amount of the house in cash.
Yeah.
And they're like, we can't give you a mortgage. I'm like, are you kidding me? So I had to pay for the whole entire thing in cash. And I'm like, you know, even though they saw that because they just have, you know, a method. Here it is. Here's what the algorithm says. And I don't care. I don't care. Whatever. It just
doesn't. Next time this happens, Frank, I'll lend you the money.
Yeah.
Just call me.
But the regulation behind the industry right now where, you know, I'm not talking about extremes. I went too far on one end of the pendulum and you don't want to go too far. Right now, we're way too far on the other end to the point where banks should be lending to people who have good credit, who have capital, who've paid their bills for the last 20 years. And that's not the case. People are having trouble borrowing right now when, you know, and that's good. My mom buying a house for my mom, she can get furniture and all this stuff. And that's good for the economy. Yeah, that could be a catalyst going forward to deregulation.
All right. Two more things. I know we're running a little bit long here, but too bad. A couple things. So any of this whole political problem, this whole Michael Flynn Trump issue, is this going to be a cloud hanging over for a while?
I don't think so. I don't know. I mean, you have to see more information come out because what we see, we saw ABC News come out and really, I mean, look terrible, right? I mean, they've been doing this for a while. And I'm not that I'm a Trump fan or you know, Democrat or whatever, but they came out and said that, I guess, what was it? President Trump actually went to Flynn and told him, they reported that, Trump went to Flynn and told him to, you know, talk to Russia right away and see where they
Oh, yeah, Kushner. Yeah. They came back
and they retracted that story, right, which is really, because that puts the markets down significantly. Yep. As far as I'm concerned on the political front, I don't think that's a big deal, but I want to get back to one more point if we can. I know we're running a little late here, but this is important because at the beginning of the podcast, we talked about, you know, fundamentals that, they do matter. They just didn't matter this year that much. but they will. I think right now as an individual investor, look at the value sectors. Look at like department store retailers. The malls aren't dead. If you think they're dead, go to a mall. I guarantee you, just buy a shirt at Macy's right now. You won't get in and out of there less than an hour and a half. The time you park and buy. I mean, yeah, and you have to realize when it comes to department stores, people say the mall's dead and that's it. It's going to be cut. It's not dead. Okay, just like the cable companies aren't dead with cord cutting. They adapt. They see the risk coming, just like the department stores. They see the risk. You look at Big Pharma had the patent cliff risk, and what they do, they took that money, invested in, you know, they created Lipitor and said, okay, let's take Lipitor and mix it in with another drug. This way we can get another big patent, and invested in small biotech companies early stage. This way they could buy those, you know, buy the whole company if the drugs turn out to be pretty good. So, you know, we saw defense companies, you know, this Quester, what did they do? Well, they saw it coming and they said, okay, well, let's invest in what the government is going to spend on. Okay, what the defense budget is going to be on, and we'll get out of the sectors that are not. So department store retailers see this coming. Big box is not dead. If they were dead, you wouldn't see companies like Amazon, Tesla, Apple opening up big box stores everywhere. So you know, there's just a mix that has to be done, and I think that's a great value sector. And I also think oil's fantastic right now. These companies pushed out their debts for a long time. So value doesn't matter right now, but if you're looking at these companies, where they're trading, you could really get some great bargains and probably get 30, 40, 50% gains inside.
Give me some names. You mean you like Macy's, you like Dillard's, you like Kohl's?
I still like JCPenney here. I think it's incredibly undervalued. They own their real estate. There's no shot at all. They have $1.5 billion in debt due over the next 5 years, and they have over $3 billion liquidity. It's not going bankrupt ever. I mean, not ever, but in the next 5-7 years, it's not.
Maybe they'll merge with Sears.
They own their real estate. Well, Sears is a different ballgame because they sold their real estate. Right. Sears could be in a lot of trouble. And, right. And not only that, they're starting to take the appliance business away. And why is that good for JCPenney? Because people don't buy appliances on Amazon. So they're able to discount appliances during the holiday season. They have the inventory levels low, extremely low. You have a cold winter right now, which is fantastic, which is like the first cold winter I think I can remember. So a lot of these guys are seeing sales explode right now, and expectations are incredibly low.
Very low.
So you're looking at Macy's, JCPenney's. I know they've come off their lows. I still think even Kohl's is a good name. I do like and the oil space, even the large names, Pioneer, Schlumberger, but even a company like Superior Energy, I think is fantastic. So Superior Energy Services, which is the fifth largest services company, oil services company behind the four majors. This is a company, I don't know how people could hold this. It's so difficult even for my people. If you pull up a 6-month chart, you'll laugh. I mean, it goes from 10 to 7 to 11 to 6 to 9. The volatility for investors, I kind of feel bad for them because they're like, why is this down 20%? Whoa, it's up 30%. What? I don't know if it's algorithms, but I know a lot of these companies are incredibly cheap.
Well, what about then back to this? Why not buy the services ETF?
You could. That's a safe way to do it. Buying a services ETF, and that's even cheap here, is a good way to do it. But remember, you got to look at the underlying stocks in the ETF because you're going to see companies that aren't services in there. And you're going to see companies maybe like an Exxon will get thrown in there. Or you'll see a Pioneer, which is a Shell producer, not a services company in there. So you want to be careful. But I think oil services are going to be very, very good going forward. Oil prices at this level, I think they're going to maintain 55 and average that going forward, which is very good. These companies are structured where they can make money at $55 a barrel. But there's a lot of good opportunities. Don't think the market's at an all-time high. There's a lot of stocks that are trading at very low levels that are depressed right now, and you're starting to see money rotate into them because they don't want to buy NVIDIA at 220 anymore at 60 times earnings.
All right. In closing, I just want to mention something to you. You know, we talked about the whole tax thing. Is this going to be good or bad for the markets and, you know, what's going on with the political front and all this? Let me just throw out this idea that I'm thinking here while you're on the discussion with me. You know, think about Christmas, and you could think of that better than I can because I'm a Jew, so I get the Hanukkah, but I get 8 days, so during Christmas time, you know, you use anticipation. It's Christmas, it's holiday, it's all that. You know, as a kid, you get your gift. You're waiting, watching it under the tree. It's, oh, I can't wait to get my gift. And finally, Christmas comes. You open up your gift. Oh, you play with it all day. I used to go over to my buddy Richie's house next door and play with it. Christmas was a great day for me. I'd go over and hang out with him and we'd get all the Christmas presents. And then after Christmas, you got that kind of hangover, that kind of like, oh, Christmas is over. I had all that time looking at the tree, looking at the presents and all this stuff. It was so exciting and all that. And then I had the crescendo where I got the gifts and I was playing with them and it was just great. And then it's the next day. You're like, oh, what's coming up next? Right? Or the end of the summer comes. The summer's there. Oh, they got the summer. And then all of a sudden, it's like the week before, like, oh, crap, I got to go back to school. I just wonder, wrapping this all the way back here, if this tax passage, at least through the Senate, and we know it's going to go further and get, you know, chopped up a bit and then back to the president. He's going to sign anything that you could put anything that says tax reform on his desk. It could be a 2-page document and he'll sign it. I mean, he's basically said that. So I wonder if this is going to be the point where now all of a sudden investors are like, what do we have next? Well, what's the next catalyst?
I'll tell you what we do have next in a catalyst. It's two catalysts you guys should look at. And I love that you say this because so many people focus on holiday season and retail sales and stuff. But in early January, a conference I attend every single year is a consumer electronics show where it's now up to like 4,000 companies, like 2.5 million square feet. You can't
is
even
that
see
the one, the one in Vegas?
In Vegas, yeah. Where all the companies unveil the products they're going to launch for 2018, which is very big. So the last couple of years have been disappointing, I'll be honest with you. Now I think you're going to see a big Bitcoin focus. IoT is going to be huge, and AI is going to dominate it. Where wearables were terrible, you know, just there's just no difference in so many of those companies and 3D printing. That and look for the early, it's conference season. So you're going to see all these companies from January, February, and a little bit into March. There's massive conference, especially in biotech, where you know, I'm not too sure where exactly the ASCO conference, but there's big conferences where they're going to produce their latest data and they wait for these conferences to do it. So you're going to see a lot of volatility. There's two sectors. There's one that the latest technology is going to be, you know, the technology sector. But we've seen, you know, again, chip companies start to get nailed. We've seen this sector do incredibly. But look at biotech, which is, you know, not a sector that's been, you know, booming, but you know, you've seen some company, but you know, a company like Celgene went from what 120 100 in one day.
I'm going back to my gene editing. I'm going back to my CRISPR technology that I really like. CRISPR and
all that stuff. Yep. Yeah. And you had a great call on my podcast when you said that, and Andrew, and also look at immunotherapy where, you know, these companies, the excitement was there. These companies went through the roof and now they've come down a lot, but you're going to see a lot of great data reported. This is amazing technology, guys. The first time in 70 years, we have an alternative to, you know, to actually try to not only treat cancer, but it's actually curing cancer in kids when they were given just 6 months to live. And, you know, you have fantastic. Your immune. It is fantastic stuff. So you're going to see a lot of this data come out January and be prepared because a lot of these stocks are going to move tremendously.
That's great. Frank Curzio from Frank Curzio Research, CurzioResearch.com. You can check out all the things over there. Thanks. Hey, listen, we're not going to talk on the show probably until next year, 2018. So have a wonderful holiday. Love to your family. And I know I'm telling you and I'm passing this through virtually, but love from all the listeners.
No, I appreciate it. My listeners love you too, man. We've been friends for a very long time since we started this. And I know you always look out for them first, man. So I'll always come on this podcast forever. And you know, I love you. And happy holidays. Happy holidays to your family too.
All right.
Man.
Talk to you. Thanks.
All right, buddy. Bye.
Well, that's going to wrap it up for this week. That was a pretty cool conversation. I felt myself talking faster and faster as Frank was talking, trying to keep up with him. He talks fast. So if I did talk too fast, you could put this on slow-mo maybe and listen. Make sure to follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is the handle. I try to put out some good information. And of course, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com where we have some information that we discussed in the show notes of this week's episode, as well as a good amount of information on all different strategies that we offer for our clients. If you're thinking about investing, maybe now's the time. Check it out, all the different strategies, the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, Global Allocations, Arrow, as well as Investology, our advisor-crafted and technology-enhanced program. So anyway, thanks for joining me. I'll see you again next week with a great guest that you're going to want to hear. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.